This is a conversation with David Ellis. We are at my house at 600 Sunset Road in Louisville, Kentucky. It is December 6th, 2000. My name is Ethel White. Well, let's start at the beginning. Can you first talk about where you were born and when?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When were you born?
I was born October 23rd, 1912. At 1030 Clay Street, Shelbyville, Kentucky.
And can you tell us a little bit about your family?
Yeah, my dad was working for Mrs. Armstrong. She was a widow of an insurance company man in Shelbyville, the Armstrong. And my daddy was a chauffeur for her when the horse and buggy days.
That's okay. We'll just let the phone ring.
When he, in those days, he would drive Mr. Armstrong to Eminence, Newcastle, in a horse and buggy. Leave the horse in the livery stables like you put your car up. He'd put the horse in it, take him somewhere else the next day. He worked for them for 50 years.
And what about your mother?
My mother was named Lula Linton.
Lula Lynn?
Lula.
Mm-hmm.
Linton.
Linton. Mm-hmm. And what was your father's name?
Rastus.
Rastus?
We call him Raz.
And what did your mother do?
My mother worked with him at the Armstrong. She was a cook at the Armstrong.
And did you grow up in Shelbyville?
Oh, yes. Coming up, I grew up in Shelbyville, just about five blocks from where my daddy worked. 1030 Clay Street, Shelbyville, where I was born and raised.
So your family lived down the street from the Armstrongs?
No, the Armstrongs was on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
We were on Clay Street.
Okay. But you didn't live on their,
no,
live
not
with
on
them.
Their place. No. It comes up later about the place. I was on, and the lady I worked for in Philadelphia, Ms. Armstrong's daughter, that's our oldest daughter, Lisbeth McCooch. Lisbeth Armstrong was our maiden name.
And why don't you talk about how that developed and
okay,
how you got from there to
okay.
to the next place.
All right. Mr. Armstrong had a big farm called Moxley. Henry Moxley was Ms. Armstrong's brother, and he ran his farm out on the old Finchfield Road, and had riding horses. And then Ms. Armstrong had a sister that was named Miss Harriet Luce, lived in New York, married to a millionaire in New York, Harriet Luce. They would come down in the summer. Instead of going down to Florida, so they come down to the farm. And that's how I met him. And then Ms. Armstrong, Mr. Luce, his wife come down, and they have parties. And I started, when I was about 18, I started working out there on the farm in the summer, helping them serve parties. They had a lot of parties. They had grandchildren. The grandchildren, I'd help them to get up on the ponies and the horses and lead them around until they got familiar with it. And our oldest daughter, Miss Elizabeth McCooch, well, she married a lawyer in the largest law firm in Philadelphia. And the name of the firm was Drinker, Biddle, and McCooch. And Mr. McCooch was the fellow that married Ms. Armstrong's daughter.
Okay.
And she had a brother. His name was Henry Moxley. Mr. Armstrong's brother, Henry Moxley. And so they did a lot of entertaining all the time out there, especially in the summer when the Luces were down there from New York, all kinds of parties. And as a little, not quite a teenager, almost a teenager, I'd had to go out there in the summer to eat, help my daddy and mother cook with the parties. That's how I got started, intern parties work.
And what did you find when you were there with the Armstrongs? What were the relationships like between you and the Armstrongs and your family and the Armstrongs?
Right. Well, Armstrongs was Mrs. Armstrong's oldest daughter, the lady that I worked for in Philadelphia.
Right.
All right. When she came, had a big wedding, a real big wedding for them out on the farm. And she always would tell me that when I got big enough, one day she wanted me to come and work for her whenever I got big enough, because she was out there, an older woman, when I was a youngster, teenager, helping them on the parties. And she always told me, when you get married, I want you to come work for me. Well, I said, yeah, well, I didn't know where, come where. I didn't ask her where, and she said, come where. So when I got married, the next time she come to Shelbyville, after that she had told me that, I had got married. And I told her, I said, I'm married, Miss Lisbeth, her name was Lisbeth. I said, I'm married, you got that job for me? I said, I sure have. I said, where is it? She said, in Philadelphia, that's where I live. I ain't never heard about no Philadelphia in my life. Yeah, Philadelphia, where is that? Then she went on to tell me, said, it's up toward New York. Well, I always said, up toward anything toward New York, I want to go see that, because New York was, everybody know about New York. So her auntie was from New York, Ms. Luce. And so they said, when she found out I was married, she said, I want you to come work for me in Philadelphia. I said, I'm over here. She said, I'll see that you get there. So she came and found out I was married, made arrangements when she got ready in Philadelphia for us. She made arrangements for me and my wife to come to Philadelphia on the train. Road train, road to Philadelphia.
Well, now go ahead.
And they lived out in Chestnut Hill. That's why I kept calling it Chestnut Hill. And I said, so when we got out there, we stayed on the place. She had two daughters, Ms. McCooch did. Two daughters, they were 6 and 7 years old. And my wife, she took care of the two daughters, and I did all the chauffeuring and the butler. I did all everything else need be done. I did it.
And first of all, when you found out you were going to Philadelphia, what was your reaction?
Well,
were you scared or excited or what?
No, I was excited because, see, being from Shelbyville, and the only big place I ever been was Louisville, and I always heard about New York, and this, and then when her sister come down there from New York, I knew she's up that way, and I was kind of anxious to go see what it's like. So she come in with my dad and made arrangements with him for me and my wife to come to Philadelphia. And asked how he liked it. And he said, told her if I liked it, he liked it. And I said, I can't tell you I like it until I see what it is. I was a dummy, and like everybody else in Shelbyville, I ain't know about no Philadelphia. Philadelphia is one of the most, Swiss White to me, is the best place anybody could go on a vacation to learn something. Downtown Philadelphia, everything is, it's the first city that had a street. And the first street, which is the oldest street in the United States, you don't know what it is?
Is that Elfris Alley?
Elfris Alley. That's right. That's the oldest street. That's the oldest street in the United States.
You would go downtown and learn about all this stuff?
From Philadelphia?
Yeah.
After I got there.
After you were there.
See,
yeah.
And we went up on train, and her daughter that was going to work for her lived in Chestnut Hill at Winston Road. You know Winston Road is?
Mm-hmm. Remember, yeah. I'm from there.
All right. You'd have to be to know where Winston Road is. Yeah, that's where they lived. And his mother lived over on St. Martin's Avenue, over in St. His mother had a big mansion house over there, Mr. McCooch's mother. And that's why I'd make trips back by Florence over there. And that's how I got to Philadelphia, through that way.
And I know some things happened before that, which we'll want to talk about. But what I want to find out right now is, what were your relationships like, first with the Armstrongs and then with the McCooches?
Oh, well, my relationship with the Armstrongs was my daddy used me as a helper. I helped him to cut grass, helped him to rake leaves, helped him to saddle the horses, helped him to do whatever, clean up the barn. Just anything my daddy had to do, I had to help him. And I had a brother too. He made both of us help him. We better get over there. But that when he come out to meet us, that there was a strap. He used to keep a razor strap hanging on the door. And after he done gave us orders to be up there, we better be up there. Don't we come back, that razor strap's waiting on us on the door.
Did your father or your mother ever say anything about how they felt about the Armstrongs?
Oh yeah, they loved Armstrong. Armstrong loved them. Miss Armstrong gave my daddy, Miss White, back in 1912. I was born in an 8-room house with electric lights and bathroom in Shelbyville. One of the few people I had, black people had that. And Miss Armstrong gave that to my dad. Yeah, sure. I was living on high horses.
And did you feel the same way about the McCooches in Philadelphia?
Well, see, the McCooches, I lived on a place. His mother, Mrs. McCooch, she was loaded. His mother was very rich, but he wouldn't give a Statue of Liberty a nickel to see it.
Mr. McCooch?
Yeah.
Eric?
He wouldn't give the Statue of Liberty a nickel to see it pee red liquor. Hmm. That's how tight he was.
Okay.
He was tight, but he had to be tight because his mother had him on a what do you call it?
Allowance?
Huh?
An allowance?
Allowance, yeah. See, he was on allowance, and of course he had to pay us, and they were nice to us. We lived a life of rally.
Okay.
They had two cars, we used the other car, one car. They'd go down to Atlantic City. It's a place down below Atlantic City called Ventnor. And there's a hotel down there. We'd go down to Ventnor and stay down there a whole week. Way they go, they'd catch the train in Philadelphia and go on down and call back and tell my wife to pack the girls. See, my wife took care of the girls. They were 6 and 7 years old, Jean and Elsa was. And take care of them. And I took care of everything else. And he told me to get in the car after I get all that and load up the car and drive on down there. I did, and we'd drive down to Ventnor, to Atlantic City, and down to Ventnor. And when we got to Ventnor, they were staying in this hotel, and he told me to see one of the waiters to get me a place to stay up in town. One of the waiters got us a place to stay up in town. And the first place he took us in that night was by Territory. We didn't even go to bed, because in the bed was just lumpy. It must have been one of the houses, where they go in and out and things. We didn't stay there. Went there. But when we, in the meantime, we just went on and stayed there. I would go to work the next day, and I got another fella to find me a place. He found us a place on Kentucky Avenue. That's when I found out that in Atlantic City, a lot of the streets are named after the states. Did you know that?
Now, you talking about Ventnor or Atlantic City now?
I'm talking about Atlantic City.
Okay. Okay.
Ventnor, down to Ventnor, that's the name of it. We were down to Ventnor in the hotel, but we stayed up in Atlantic City.
Okay.
Because the waiter took us up.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's...
And then At that, see, as the girls got up, well, I got a good education by doing that with the girls, because they furnished their car to take kids to school and things. And in Philadelphia, you know how far it is from Chestnut Hill, downtown, Middletown, downtown? How far?
Yeah, well, that's 30 or 35 minutes.
Huh? 30. No, I ain't talking about the minutes it takes you. How far is mileage?
In miles? What is that, about 10 miles?
More than that.
Is it?
18 miles from down, he's 1429 Warner Street. That, I know what Philadelphia like it here. See? And that's why he was. So I tell I had to, my job was, I'd take him to the train in the morning, go up to the way to get the train to go in town, and then come back and pick up the girls, and take them to the two schools. And those schools up there are 20, 15, or 20 miles apart. You know, everything looked like it was so far apart. And I'd do that, and after I'd get them placed in the school, I'd get back. Well, Miss McCooch, she's ready to go play bridge or somewhere. So I'd have to take her different places, take bridge. And then then when I go back in the evening to get her from playing bridge, time to pick up the kids. The kids' school was about 20 miles apart. I can't think of the names of where they were.
They didn't go to Springside?
Well, it could have been, of the names, I don't
know. But not in Chestnut Hill?
No, it's out.
Shipley or Baldwin or Irwin or...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, time I'd job in, I'd go get her. And time I get her, time to go pick up the kids. See? Then after I pick up the kids, two kids, and got them settled out, and get something else settled, it's time to get Mr. Coach coming back down there.
But you said you lived the life of Riley.
Oh, I did. I was driving Riley and riding, seeing all this stuff I never seen before, going to these new schools. And I said, oh, yeah, shoot.
Well, now, can we back up just a little bit? Because,
yeah.
You know, we've talked about working for the Armstrongs and then moving into working for the McCooches. But somewhere in between there, you had some military experience.
No.
No?
No.
That came later?
All my military came after I left. I was back in Louisville. See, we went up to...
okay, so what years were these?
The years I'm talking about was 1937. That's when we first went to Philadelphia.
Okay.
1937.
Okay.
Through 1940.
Okay. And, okay, what happened in 1940?
1940, we went back to Kentucky.
And why?
Why? Well, we went back to Kentucky in 1940. My daughter was born. See, when my daughter was born, my wife had a baby. When she was born, I had to give up the Coots' job because my baby needed her mother. I was rewarded just working with different ones and McCooch would get to, I didn't like that, working with different ones. You know, they'd have to hire different people, because when we worked for them, my wife did all the cooking for McCooch and I did the service, all that.
Oh, so your wife needed not to be working all the time. Is that what you're saying?
She had to quit work.
Okay.
Because, see, I had my baby. You see my baby, she's a beauty, ain't she?
She is. So you moved back to Kentucky to find other employment.
That's right.
Okay. And what did you find when you got back here?
Oh, when I got back to Kentucky, I worked in the... I came on to Louisville. I stopped in Shelbyville for a while. But I come to Louisville, and my brother-in-laws, both of them worked at the American Air Filter. And he knew some of the big shots of American Air Filter. They lived on Life and Road. And
you mean the people who ran it, the executives?
Yeah.
Okay.
American Air Filter. Well, so by my brother-in-law was being there, and Mr. Tarrant was one of the top lawyers in Kentucky. My other brother-in-law worked for him. So the two of them got me a job working for a man that was president of American Air Filter.
So you worked for in his house?
Yeah, took care of the house. I did the cooking and everything. Because my wife still wasn't working because I got the head of this baby.
So you worked for the head of American Air Filter or
Yeah, he's
somebody
one of
else.
The heads.
Okay,
he's one of,
an
one
executive.
Of the John Hailstrom was his name. He was one of the heads.
John Hailstrom, okay. All right, and where were you living? Were you living with him or were you living in your own house?
I was living in where I got drafted from, in Beecher Terrace, where I shouldn't. I could have been living out there in their house and missed the Army.
All right, let's tell. Why don't you tell that story? That's a good one.
Because I was so glad, you know, to get out from living out there with them. I moved in town to Beecher Terrace. And in Beecher Terrace neighborhood, it was loaded with 18, 19, 20-year-old boys. And yeah, I was 1940 to see what I was.
Well, you were born in 1912.
Yeah.
So you were 28?
Good. That's about that.
Yeah. Okay. So you were living in Beecher Terrace, and there were a lot of 18 to 20-year-olds.
Oh, yeah.
And were you... You had to register for the draft,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, uh-huh. But I didn't have to register where I did, but I did.
Where did you register?
I registered in Indian Hills, out there off of Life Road, where my man, where I lived. Because I was staying out there till I got all my stuff moved out from Shelbyville, so I considered that my home. I lived on, he had a bathroom and room on the side of the garage I stayed in, till I got my wife down there. And while I was there, when I messed up and rested out there.
And you need to explain how it was that you messed up, or why did that mess it up?
Because I wouldn't have had to go to the Army. If I'd have rested down at 12th and Wanted, man, they were loaded with 18, 19-year-olds. And
now,
I was 30 years old.
Yeah, but you told me, you need to tell for the tape what you told me in the car,
right.
Which was they were taking even numbers of black and white. Young man.
They have to. That's what the guy told me, because I asked him, how come you to take us? There were two other fellas out there, same age. I said, how come you to take us and all you got all these men? He said, we have to have so many colored, so many blacks, and so many whites. We can't just take all blacks, all whites. He said, when we draft so many colored and so many whites. And said, you fell into, by not having a whole lot of colored out here, you always felt right.
There weren't enough black people in Indian Hills, right?
No, that's right. That's something, wasn't it? I told you I've had some kind of life, Miss. Don't you think I have?
I do. That's why you're here.
Okay.
All right, so what happened after you registered? Did you register? How did you end up in the Air Force?
Oh, the Air Force? the Army, I didn't have nothing to do with that. I just was Army. In the Army, they put me in the Air Force. Send me.
It was the Army Air Force.
The Army Air Force, 20th Air Force. The 20th Air Force, their headquarters was in Tampa. And Tampa was 9 miles from MacNeil Field. I was out of MacNeil Field. That's where I was taking training.
Now you need to tell that story too. You promised you could do this twice.
I can. Yeah.
All right. Now, what were you being trained for?
At MacNeil Field, as engineers for the 20th Air Force. And engineers, I mean, the type of engineers we were, we build runways, the Quonset huts, electric line, I had people for everything that they need. Well, I helped to build a highway it's a highway there in Okinawa on the China Sea. Well, it's, On that highway, I helped to build that highway. I ran
on Okinawa.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't gotten there yet. Okay.
On the China Sea, yeah. We helped to build a highway, and what I helped. See, I told you they sent me to the heavy equipment, and I learned how to operate. We call it the shovel, the thing that dips in. Right? That's we call it a shovel.
Okay.
It is a power shovel. Dig, I operated that, all right. Then I was so good in that, I moved up to operating, took me off to fixing the highway to build Quonset hut and fix the runways. And on that, I used the same machine that called shovel, but it is you change the take the shovel part off and put another on, which is called a clamshell. The clamshell is the one you see come down with two things and pick it. You've seen that?
The two sides come together.
Yeah, and it opens up the lemon. That's called a clamshell. That's not the hardest part. The hardest thing to operate on that shovel. I told you about that. It's other called a dipper stick. That's a clamshell. But you know the hardest one to operate?
What?
The drag line.
What does that do?
That's the thing they have on there. It'd be hanging on it. And they take it out there to clean out a ditch.
And they
drop
it.
And then the thing will pull it in and bring it up. Mm-hmm. That's drag line. And that's the hardest one to operate. You know why? Because when you wheel it off on a drum, that cable's going like a mile a minute. And if you don't stop that in the right spot, the cable crosses. Mm-hmm. And then keep doing that, it'll break. So you got to be able to stop that. It's an inner guide thing, drum in there. Stop it in that drum. During the day, you're going to get a broken cable. That's why it was so hard.
You were trained to do this in Florida,
that's
is
right.
That right?
In Florida, sure was.
And you told me that you got to know the officers.
Oh yeah.
Because of an office in Tampa. There was MacDill, the base, and then there was an office downtown, right?
Yeah, the office downtown was for the 3rd Air Force. That's what it was in. Mm-hmm. That was the 3rd Air Force's headquarters. And
you were in the 20th Air Force?
Well, 20th, the 3rd, it's the same one.
Okay. How did you get along with the officers?
Man, I'm telling you, all officers, they like same way I get along with your people. They like me.
You.
The officer, that's why I got, I told you, I had a maid job. I went to Fort Myers and all them other places because the officers wasn't allowed to drive. We had to drive a Jeep. I got to drive them around everything. Other guys didn't get to do it because they liked me.
And you started out as a private.
Oh yeah.
And then you
sergeant.
And then you made sergeant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Did you ever think about being an officer?
No more than what I was doing. No.
You were content.
I was content. I see way. Other officers got to be tough and rough. Like I don't want to be into that because they balling some guys out. Don't give a darn about them. I didn't want to be involved in that. I stayed. I was staying in that in my head, man, when I get out, I'll be able to make some money because this pay is good. That work pays good. Mm-hmm. If I can make $40-some an hour operating that stuff.
Okay, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But the Army was segregated during the war.
Oh, yeah.
Did you feel that particularly?
Oh, yeah. We feel it every day. You could feel it.
How'd you feel about it?
How'd I feel about it?
Well, I mean, did you accept it, or did it make you mad, what?
No, the only thing making us mad about that is when they would come and be some jobs available that we could do, they'd give us a white boy. That's the only thing. That's the only thing that hurt us, made it feel bad.
Yeah. But by and large, you felt you were treated okay other than that?
Oh, they can't treat you as a person. Different man, because they'd be calling on carpet, but they could got away punishing you for not what they want to do, but not assigning you to the jobs that the good jobs. We always got the jobs that nobody else wanted. I spent my 88 years on this earth. That's what I had to live with, and that's tough. You don't realize how tough it is till you be involved in that. It's hard. No, it really makes you. I get tears in my eyes now sometimes. When we got unsegregated, we was on the ship getting ready to come home, and we had Okinawa. I was in Okinawa about a year. And Truman, unsegregated army. And they had ships, Miss White, as far as you could see, loaded up. They were going to invade Japan. Loaded up with Japan. Okinawa was closer to Japan. And when he passed that bill, the whistles started blowing and everything on the ship. He said, "Oh Lord, they're ready to invade Japan." That's what they've been loading for all the time. We thought we were going to go ahead and invade Japan. But they're blowing a thing called the army. War was over. Yeah. That's right. Boy, it really felt good then. There's more blowing and hollering and going on then after that. Yeah, we was in the harbor there at Okinawa. Yeah.
So the ships were in the Okinawa Harbor.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Where they were.
Uh-huh. Loaded.
Well, now how did you get to Okinawa?
Oh, I got to go to. I got on the boat at. When I got on the ship in.
Did you go to California?
Yeah, I was in California. When I got on the ship to go.
Let me pause this while we think for a sec.
Thing is, I got on the, took my basic training in Florida at Tampa, MacDill Field. All right, when we left MacDill Field, we went to, what's the city in Florida now they're talking about?
Miami?
No, not Miami.
Long Beach?
No, we're the capital. Where
Tallahassee.
Tallahassee.
Okay.
When we went to Tallahassee, and they loaded us on the train, on a 17-car train, and on a Monday. And we stayed on that train till Saturday night. And on that Saturday night, from Monday to Saturday night, we wound up in Seattle.
And how was the train ride?
Well,
long.
Long and but we'd get off at places and it'd run us around the block and get a bit of exercise. Because I got off, show you how dumb I was, I got off, train went through Fulton, Kentucky. And when I saw Kentucky, and that, because I felt happy because Kentucky, I didn't realize Fulton, Kentucky was almost far away from where Florida was. I was really happy when I saw that. And they'd make us jog around the block two or several times, get back on the train. We got on that train until Saturday night before we got off. And we unloaded in Seattle.
Okay.
And that's why we got on our ships.
And you got on the ship.
I got on. And the kind of ships I went across was LST.
Across the ocean in an LST?
LST.
Aren't the LSTs the landing boats?
That's right. And we had 15 of them.
How many people in an LST? How many people were in an LST?
LST? Oh, I don't know how many people they had. See, the Navy men. I don't know.
They're not very big, though, are they?
Oh, yeah, they're big.
Oh, are they?
Okay. The LST we had, we didn't need them. But the tanks, we run, I think, get about 4 tanks in there. And trucks. Because when the LST gets there, where they're going, look, let me show you. They had this big gate come down in front, and they just pull right out. And that's why they had LSTs. There was 15 of them. And we stayed there. We had to load them in Seattle. We were there about 7 days, loading them ships. We knew it was going somewhere as big. I told you they were getting ready to invade Japan. But we didn't know that. We knew it was something big coming up, what they were doing.
Do you remember what year that was? I mean,
That was 1939.
Well, no, because you
went in 1936.
No, you went in the army after. You went back to Kentucky in 1940.
Yeah.
So you would have gone into the army right after that.
That's right.
40 or 41.
Yeah, 40. I got.
So was this right before the war was over?
No, I got out of the army in 1946.
Okay. Okay. All right, so this, so you're sent to Okinawa.
All that's in 1940s.
Right, okay, I've got it.
See, I went in 1940 and got out in 46. I was in there 3 years.
Okay.
3 years I was in the Army.
Okay, so you... So you went to Okinawa, and then you said something about building a highway there.
On Okinawa, we were building the China Sea. Okinawa is surrounded by the Pacific Ocean and the China Sea. Mm-hmm. And then the China Sea part is where we saw these ships, big ships. Mm-hmm. But all along the ocean there in Okinawa, it was these ships. That's why we were docked in these docks. As far as you can see, ships loaded. And I asked the officers why there were so many ships there. He said, they're going to invade Japan. Mm. And I said, all them ships loaded for to invade Japan. It was. Man, aren't they? They'd have wiped Japan out if they hadn't. You never seen such a mass of ships in your life, Miss. Boy, and
did you think about invading Japan?
I thought, Lord, have mercy. I hope I don't. I was thinking about my daughter and my daughter and my wife. Because I thought about them, really thought about them. So, because my daughter, she was just 3 years old. She was six when I got out.
And you thought something might happen to you if you invaded Japan?
Mm-hmm. See, when... From 3 years old till six, I wasn't with her. I was in service. What made it hard for us in service? We in service, a segregated service. They moved us around. You know, that's terrible.
Now, tell me how it was segregated.
Well, the promotions would come up that we were more qualified field than if they give it to a white boy.
What about the living arrangements and eating arrangements and all that?
Well, we all eat.
You all eat together?
And slept together.
Slept together. Mm-hmm. But you got done out of the good jobs.
Yeah.
Okay, you got out of the Army, and you had been trained in heavy equipment operating.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to look for a job.
I went in there with the private office, and they kept telling me I had heard that like a song. They said, oh yeah, that's good, but blacks don't get these jobs. Don't give it to blacks. And you didn't see no blacks doing it neither around here.
Not for a long time.
That's right. Yeah. That's the first thing I applied for. I was so good in it. Miss White, what experience you've had me? Anything that I do or things I do, don't you think I'm good?
You're good at everything you do.
Well, I tried that. I could operate them bulldozers and graders. Man, I'm telling you, you'd see, we'd show out, see who could load a truck the fastest and all that. We'd bet on it. And when we was out at Okinawa, we said at night, we on night shift, had a 24-hour shift. On night shift, we'd be over there loading the trucks. We'd be on that highway along the China Sea. I helped to build that. And we'd be on that highway, and it's getting that coral out of the mountains. The mountains are coral. That's what they're coral. It looks like a cement has been wet and refroze. That's what we had to dig. We used to bet. I used to win money. Who would load the truck the fastest? I told one of them big cranes, dipper stick, just two buckets, loaded a truck. That's how big it was. Loaded a truck. But see, people say, "Oh, you can do that." Little size didn't mean a thing. It's skill you had. The skill. All the brakes are automatic. The power brakes and things. You don't have to have no strength, no fear. You have to have skill how to do that. And skill is one thing, patting myself on the back, skill is one thing I'm loaded with. Yeah, really.
Well, and what did you tell your wife when you found there were no jobs for blacks in the construction?
Back.
Yeah, after you got back.
She just told me to keep on looking. Yeah. I did.
But I mean, what did you tell her? I mean, you had to come home and say.
Oh yeah.
No
yeah.
jobs for.
Yeah, I come home so excited that I knew how to operate this stuff. I tell them all, bragging about it and everything. And I said, first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to the employment office and try to get a job doing that. Mm-hmm. And they all agreed, oh, I hope you do. Go ahead. I did. Mm-hmm. I wind up, that's how I wind up at the distillery, being a janitor and a mill. You know.
Now this was where?
At Shinley Distillery.
Did that frustrate you?
Yeah, it frustrated me because I was thinking I was going to be able to do what I did good. And of course, I did. Well, any job I did good. But I thought I was going to get one of them high-skill paying jobs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you didn't get paid as much for the janitor job?
No, I got paid. The job I had. It was a good job. I made $250 a week. That was a good job. Because I belong to the union. But I could have made more than that. Mm-hmm. See, I was anxious to make more because I want to get a home. And now my little bungalow that I have there, I bought that house. It was cheap for $7,000. That was cheap.
When did you buy that?
Bought that in 1940. That was cheap, but $7,000 wasn't no cheap to me, cause
not in the 1940s especially.
I hadn't made, but I didn't even make at least $100 until just before I got out of the Army. My little work, of course, my wife got that pent the thing they call it. They got a name they call that what women. Receive when their husband's in the Army.
It's not a pension?
No, it's like a pension, but they don't call it that. It's another name they call it. She'd get that every month. My wife's one was rich when I was in the Army. She gets a pension and everything else.
Oh yeah, you said, you might mention that. You told me that in the car too, yeah. About the promotion. When you became sergeant, you made more money?
Oh, yeah. I made $116 a month. And the $16, excuse me, I could have, there wasn't nothing me to spend the money for, but cigarettes or drink all out of beer. I'd save my $16 and send $100 to my wife. So, and she was getting $80 allotment, you know, for me. So back in 1940, $180, that's a whole lot of money for you to be getting a week.
Well now, how long did you stay with Shenley?
35 years. Mm-hmm. From 1937 to 1947?
No, after
46,
the Army?
40, yeah, 47, mm-hmm. after
mm-hmm.
Army.
Until 1977? 70 till 82?
Okay. How many years is that?
That's 35 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were doing other things too?
I was waiting table. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my lifesaver. Me waiting table.
When did you start that?
I started waiting table back before I went in the Army. Before I went in the Army. Because, see, the type of work I was doing, working for Mr. Hellstrom, he's the one who got me started because he was the president of American Craft Filter. And by me, I stayed on his side of his garage back there until I could get out of the project. And then by me being there, he said, Ellis, said, I'm going to let you make some extra money. I said, hi. He said, come on, I'm going to let you do this party. Get up and show you how to do this party. And he showed me how to do the party. And most people that see me do a party ask me and want to hire me themselves. That's how I kept so busy. People would see what I did, how I do it, and see that I wasn't drunk like the guests was, and then they'd hire me. See? So these other waiters drink up the people's liquor, and when the party's almost over, they're drunker than your guests. Not me. I still got the same sober head I had when I come in at it.
Well, now, David, what did you think when you, especially in the beginning, you would work at a party and you said you weren't drunk like the guests were? What did you think of the guests?
Oh, the guests?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a group. I mean, really.
What I think of the guests, that's a poor way to say I'm having a big time. That's the only thing I think. My brother's an alcoholic. I got a brother that's in the nurse home now. He was an alcoholic. My sister was an alcoholic. And I never touched stuff. And the bottle of money, payday that I'd get at where I worked, I would take it. And I drove to Cleveland all the time to my daughter's. And when I'd go to Cleveland, I'd take him this whole case of whiskey that I'd saved up, because they partied, and couldn't afford it. And I'd take it and give it to them. Yeah, I kept him plenty of whiskey, because a lot of my bosses would give me an extra bottle. Help in the office a bottle at payday, but this the regular help out in the distillery didn't get that. All right, so since I did this to that office, I told my boss, man, I said, look here, I said, I'm passing this whiskey out every payday to the people. Said, yeah, that's right. That's what we want you to do. I said, well, how come I don't get none? I don't get a single bottle, and I'm passing it out. He said, oh, you don't get none? I said, no, I ain't going to take none. First bottle I take, I lose my job. Said, I stole some whiskey. So I said, no, I'm not taking it. They said, well, take one. I said, if I take one, somebody see me, you going to hold up for me? Say I didn't do it. Say, yeah, I sure will. So I started taking a bottle every month. I was living it, handling it anyway. I said, this is the way of the thing y'all got me in, handling all this whiskey, and I can't even get none of it. I didn't want it. I never drank in my life. I'd want it for my wife. My wife drinks, and the people that she associated with did. I never did.
Well, now, when you went into the business of waiting tables, and you really had your own business, is what you had.
Oh, yeah, I did that. I did that by reading I had my own business. See, by me working for the president of American Alcoholics Association, they had a lot of parties. I met a lot of people. Well, they began to hire me, and I was the one that gets the jobs. So therefore, that's why I could get other guys, because they knew that I could get parties. And the guys that I'd give them a lecture. I'd tell them, y'all leave the people's liquor alone. It's not y'all's party. You wasn't invited to party to do nothing but the work. And I want y'all to do that. And I'd watch them, scrutinize them. That's why Roger, I worked on him. He don't party. But
well, now you said it saved you doing that. What did? How did you mean that? Waiting tables. You said it saved you.
Saved you because I couldn't get no job doing what I was good to do. I still couldn't get a job operating no heavy equipment.
So you really needed to have two jobs in order to make up for the fact that you couldn't get the
That's
heavy
right.
equipment
I
job.
I wouldn't have had one job, but because you just yourself. Until here lately, you never seen a black operating this other heavy stuff. It's all white.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel that you were, once you went into this business of waiting tables and bartending and everything, how were you treated in these white people's homes?
Well, I was treated fine, real fine, just like you too. Ain't nobody in the world could treat anybody better than you. Really, now that's saying a lot, because I show you fine people I've served. Very fine people.
I think you should. I think it's really interesting some of the people you've served now.
Yeah.
Why don't you name some well known names of people you've talked to?
All right, well known names. Now look, Miss Bingham. Mm-hmm. She was very particular. I was her main man. Miss Bingham called me from Florida, telling me they. The morning he died about between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning.
Well, this is Mrs. Bingham, Sr.
Yeah, Sr. My phone rang,
And I went to the phone, and Mr. Bingham said, "David." I said, "Yes, ma'am." He said, "Mr. Bingham passed this morning." I said, "Oh, Lord, yeah, Mr. Bingham, I'm so sorry about it." She said, "Now, I want you to come out here every day until he's put away." I said, "I can't, Mr. Bingham." I said, "Why not?" "My wife and I were loading my car up to go to Cleveland."
Yeah.
So I didn't do it. I was going to load and go to Cleveland. So I sent Hodge and Dunbar. I gave Dunbar a lot of parties. Because he's one of the main guys that I gave a lot of parties to, because he used me a lot himself. And by him using me, I in turn gave him parties when I couldn't go. But
you also, now for instance, you showed me some, excuse me, some, shall we call them autographs, in your wallet.
Yeah.
And who are some of the people that you met that would come into houses like the Binghams, and you would talk to them?
Oh, a lot of them I didn't know their name.
But I'm talking about people like Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Roger Mudd, the main man, on CBS.
Dan Rather?
Dan Rather?
Mm-hmm.
Had a long part time. Bob Dole.
Oh, you want to tell that story.
Yeah. Mr. Osley, you don't believe it, ask Mr. Osley Brown. Mr. Osley Brown had Bob Dole and his wife as house guests and had a party for him. And one of our waiters, a light-skinned guy, named Mackey. He's our main man, but he always took me with him. He had me out to the party the night Bob Dole was there. Bob Dole come out to the bar talking politics, and I told him, I said, "Nah, you know, Mr. Dole, you can't say that. This is a Democrat. These Democrats out here working. You have to wait till you come to a bar and we'll have some Republicans if you want to talk like that."
Who said that?
I told Senator Dole. He started following me, Then I said, "Hey, Senator Dole, you better cut now, because I don't want these people to think I'm boy." So I went on back out to the bar and looked up there. He was again, wanted to finish her. And so Mr. Osley Brown, him, and if you know her, she'll tell you they still laugh about that. She asked Mackey, said, "Have any of y'all seen Senator Dole lately?" Said, "Yes, ma'am." Said, "Well, where is he?" Said, "He's out there at the bar arguing with Dave." They had to come get him, because I wouldn't let him get away, because I kept throwing stuff on him at the Republicans. Now, Bush, I'm so glad that since my man didn't win, they're going to get an example of the Republicans. Republicans are the lousiest bunch of dudes. They are. I don't mean all Republicans.
We're on tape, David.
they are. They ain't never done that. Look, well, I take it back. I was going to ask you that question first. Which Republican president you think that did something direct for blacks?
You'll have to tell me.
Eisenhower. That's the only Republican president ever did anything direct for the blacks. Now they keep on hollering about Abraham Lincoln. That wasn't direct for the blacks. That was save the nation. That wasn't to save us. Save the nation, wasn't it?
What did Eisenhower do?
Eisenhower did two great things. One of the best things that ever happened to us. First thing he did, he sent the army down at
Little Rock
to let them kids in their school. That was direct for us, wasn't it? All right. The next thing he did, direct for us, yeah. He, when it was opening into the Supreme Court, he picked the liberalest man ever lived in the United States to be the head of the Supreme Court.
Earl Warren?
That's right, liberalest guy in the world.
put him ahead of Truman. When he did that, Lyndon Johnson come in there and passed 23 civil rights bills right in a right in rotation. Never done before. See what I mean? That's what I have an idea. That was great. Now, when you say something about the Republican, they come up, first thing they say, well, what about Abe Lincoln? What I say, what about him? Well, what did he do for nothing for us, for the nation? He did something to save the nation, so the nation would come together. That's why that wasn't us. We were going to go whichever way y'all went. We were going to go anyway. It wasn't for us. Lincoln didn't do nothing for us.
What do you think about the Emancipation Proclamation?
Well,
was that
they don't hold it up. They should hold it up. Mm-hmm. They don't.
That's right. It didn't operate in Kentucky.
So. No. But Eisenhower, believe it or not, he's the one. That was direct for us, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Do you think he knew what Earl Warren was going to
do? Oh, yeah. Earl Warren. Everybody knew Earl Warren was a liberal guy because did nothing to go... that one liberal go through California unless it went through Earl Warren. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they knew that. Mm-hmm. Just like, let's see. Just like they knew that about Earl Warren, I was going to tell you about my, like old guy down in Georgia. He's going to be 100 years old now.
Strom Thurmond?
Yeah, Strom Thurmond. Don't everybody know why he is? Mm-hmm. He worth two dead flies. All we talking about, Strom Thurmond will be 100 years old. I don't care if he be 500 years old. He still ain't no count, no good.
Well, now, help me put together what you said about that and what you said about your own life in that the hardest thing for you, as I understand, if I'm right, was when you couldn't get a job. You had the talent, but you couldn't get
couldn't
a job because you weren't white.
That's right.
Okay.
That's that.
And when you talk about Republicans who do or do not do things to help blacks, is that essentially what you're talking about?
That's right.
The equal opportunity to get a job.
And not only get a job on anything, Republicans don't.
Just
that's why they come talking about Abe Lincoln to us. So Abe Lincoln, I said, what did Abe Lincoln do? Well, he freed y'all. I said, he didn't free us for just the sake of what you talk about freeing. He did that to save the nation. I said, he freed y'all. Y'all was just in the hook, only different one hook, but he saved the nation. That was for all of us. But the other thing didn't have nothing to do with y'all. It was just direct for us.
But when you're talking about, when you talk about all the legislation that well, was passed under Johnson, particularly, the civil rights legislation.
That's right, yeah. 23 of them.
And all of these, in other words, if they had been passed, say, earlier, and had affected your life,
they would have got the same credit.
But what it would have meant for you, essentially, was being able to get as good a job
as
a white person who had as many talents and as much training as you.
Yeah.
That's what it all boils
down
to.
That was all down. Yeah. That's the only thing, main thing that's the white race. See, white race, we were misunderstood. The white, when I said white race people, that don't mean all of you, but I mean the whole. What they do to the blacks, the first thing that they like when they talk about the blacks going to school, or let them go to school, the first thing the white man said, do you want to marry your daughter? I said, man, where's your daughter? Show me, let me see your daughter. I said, nobody would pick you. Oh, you want to pick some white? I said, they don't color, the black people don't have to pick no white person to do nothing. Don't you know in the colored race we got every color you can find? My wife is white as you. See, they were on to them. They don't do that, but that's what they do. I said, first thing they said to somebody to scare them, talking about you want to marry, I don't want them to marry my daughter. Talk about man, you want one to marry your daughter? No, I don't want one to marry my daughter neither.
I ain't talking about man, I'm talking about what you do for the nation to try to save the people.
Well, now, what about things like, I mean, in the Louisville area until into the 1960s, the parks were segregated.
That's
the,
right.
All kinds of things were segregated.
That's right.
Now,
mm-hmm.
Now, what did you, I mean, how did you feel about that, and what real difference did it make to you?
It made a whole lot of difference. The job situation was way bad. That's why we like the Binghams. They didn't have to do that. They had all the money they wanted. But they, anything came up to help us, they was a bit with it. Didn't have to. Man, they could afford more than anybody by other white people anyway to not have nothing to do with us. But they didn't. That's the way we pick them up. Like Mayor Aveson. He was a good man.
Okay. You were saying?
I said this, that the Republicans, they the only thing they can say, they come talking about Abraham Lincoln. But that's stupid. Abraham Lincoln, anybody been to school, he done that to save the nation. But the only Republican president ever did something direct for Negroes was Eisenhower. And that's the only one I know.
Well, now, tell me for a minute about school, about going to school. Your daughter going to school.
All right, going to school. See, the first thing, Miss White, that's why the whole thing's a mess bad. We have been the victim of bad publicity.
Bad publicity?
Bad publicity. That's the main thing that's hurt the black people in the United States. Bad publicity. Because the white people, by y'all having everything that you wanted, doing anything you wanted to do, naturally, you look down on the colored, say, and the colored wouldn't be in that category because they couldn't do them things y'all do, couldn't afford it. And by them being raggedy, ain't doing things y'all do, you'll tell your kids, look, see how they live, you see how they live, see how they do. But they don't tell the kids the thing why they're living that way. They're living that way because the things that's available to you people there, they all of our lives, we ain't been, had the privilege to go after those kind of jobs. Mm-hmm. And if it did, they didn't hire us. But you got to have a job to do anything. So if they don't hire us, naturally we're on a standstill. We can't do nothing. But the first thing I said they always want to do, they're scared a black's going to marry his daughter. I said, who in the world will marry somebody just because of what the color they are? I said, we got all kinds of color people in our race. We pick out a color. But anybody don't pick out somebody of color? I said, I know he pick out the whitest woman that he can see. And they go out courting. And they turn the lights out. Now, how's he going to tell what color she is? He told them that by how he likes her. I said, for the likes. Ain't the color. Oh, look, the blacks really don't pay no attention to color. Because I said, I could bring 10 waiters out here with me. And won't no two of us be the same color. Do you ever think about that? Don't have to get 10. Take two or three of us. No, we won't be the same color. One will be tan, other a little tanner, other black, a little blacker, some so black they're blue.
And so it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter to us. It's what you do matters. How you do a thing. How it hurts a person. That's what matters. What do you think I care about what color you are if you're doing something that's going to mess me up? If you do something good, I'm thinking about the color, I'm thinking about how good you did. That's what I think about it. I say my wife is as light as you. And she's lighter than that, a little lighter than that when I first met her. Her whole family was light. Why are they light? Yeah, why are they light? I can't produce nobody that light. Yeah. See what I mean? Right now, a white man has done that all his life.
Done what?
Produced these white colored people. And then now you want to be bothered with them. Yeah. We didn't do it. He's the one did. We didn't care about what color somebody is. I ain't met no lady nowhere nicer than you. If you're a Hellcat, you can be white as snow. Still a Hellcat. Or black as ace of spades. You're still a Hellcat. Until you change what you are and how you act and things, you're still whatever. Yeah.
Well, now, do you bear a grudge, Earl? Do you bear a grudge about this?
No.
You don't?
No, what I do, I feel sorry for a person being that ignorant. Really, that's what I feel sorry for, anybody that ignorant. Just because a guy is black, you're going to say, all right, take your dog, your animals for you. Suppose you got some puppies, and some come, this is black, this is brown, this is white. You gonna pick him out to cause another car? It's still a dog. that's ridiculous. Ridiculous. So that's why it's so ridiculous to us. We laugh about it, but it is. If you're bad, you're bad. I don't care if you're white as snow or black as ace of spades. You're still bad. You're good. You're good.
Well, how have you? I mean, given all this that you're talking about, I mean, how have you worked through it all? How have you managed to lead your life within it or around it?
Well, I lead to live because with our mother and daddies have taught us that the white people own everything, they run everything, and we have to do what they say. If we don't do what they say, they can make it tough for us. Now, we know that. And that's why we fall in line, do what they say.
Do you think they were right?
To do that? No, nobody's right.
No, were your parents right to teach you that?
Yeah. Huh?
Were your parents right to teach you that?
If they didn't know no better.
To do what the whites said.
Yeah, uh-huh. They didn't know no better, sure. It don't matter why you're white or brown. On that, it depends on how you've been taught.
Well, now, what about the Black Power thing that came along? What about some of these civil rights movements?
All right, the Black Power and civil rights movement is this: the white J. Strom Thurmond, the guy I was talking about, ain't he been a white power down south all the time? Well, that's what the Black Power. Jesse Jackson comes along, takes the other side. That's the Black Power.
But I mean, this is different than doing what your parents taught you to do, which was to do what the whites told you.
Now,
these people aren't doing that.
All right.
And I want to know what you think about that.
The people
is that smart?
Sure, smart. Oh, sure, smart. They're smart. But we weren't smart. The reason we weren't smart, that we didn't have no opportunity to get old to anything to make you smart. We couldn't go to school that would make us smart. Until they put this about the schools, we weren't getting the proper teaching to make you smart.
So do you think there's been some progress?
A lot of progress.
A lot of progress?
Well, a lot of progress. Yes. It's almost wiped out. Really? Yes. But anyway, and the country's been better, too, and everything for that. This is terrible back when the country was real segregated. That was all. And stupid. Really. It's because he's black. He can't do it because he's black. Well, you don't segregate the animals. You don't segregate your pets. I seen some people have the blackest little dog they ever seen it up in their arm.
Did you take part in or watch any of the civil rights demonstrations that were going on around here? No,
I didn't take part in it.
You were busy.
that's right. That's what I was going to tell you. I was out to one of y'all's house somewhere. Yeah. I was really busy when I was waiting to hear. Mm-hmm.
But you were happy to see it, to know that it was going on.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it happened. And we fur everybody that knows that's going on. That's why when the guys try to get the black vote, they try to get the black vote to help them because they figured the blacks going to vote that way. But the blacks in this thing of about Bush, now why do you think he got Powell to be his Secretary of State? Because he's black. That's because so he'd build up with something just so he could say, I got a black. Well, he has. Well, we can't argue against that. But you know what we do? I do it special. I tell him what I want. When Bush gets in, I'm going to tell you, I want, you still got the log cabin up at Washington that Abraham Lincoln was in? He said, yeah. I said, get another one for Adam Clayton Powell.
Adam Clayton Powell?
Not Adam Clayton Powell.
You mean Colin Powell?
Colin Powell.
Okay.
I said, tell him to build nothing. We had you to build nothing for Clarence Thomas. And I want you to build nothing for Powell. That's all they are, Thomas. That's exactly all they are, Thomas.
So
when here's this whole race of people are trying to get these guys eliminated, and here he, I'm a secretary. You ain't a secretary of nothing for me.
So it doesn't make you feel good that...
No, don't make you... We don't feel good when they get a guy like Clayton Powell.
Colin Powell.
Colin Powell, or somebody like that gets a job. Because the Colin Powell is an army man. He's good for whoever got him because he knows that stuff. Mm-hmm. But that ain't good for us.
Would you feel differently if Bush got somebody that you would consider to be the right black man for the job?
Yeah.
That would be different.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the right man is to be a man that's upholding the things that we're trying to get. So, Colin Powell, I give him credit, he's a good military man, good all of that, but he's no good for us. Mm-hmm. Me, particularly.
Well, I've got one more question, and that is, what do you think about the fact that now the white people, say the white politicians, now realize that they need black votes?
That's right.
Is that sort of interesting to you or amusing to you? Or is this part of the progress that's been made? I guess.
No, that ain't amusing to me. What's amusing to me, and if we get a guy that do what Eisenhower did,
you want to see some more real progress,
that's
is what
right.
you want.
Yeah. I told you what he done. What he done, that was great.
So we're better off than we were, but we've got some ways to go still.
We're better off because we finally did something that was right. See, it ain't gonna never be right, better off until they do it right. And the way they do is just like telling a lie. You got to keep on lying till you tell the truth. And it ain't gonna never be straight till you tell the truth. He can get all the Colin Powells he wanted and all that stuff. If they don't eliminate this segregated stuff, it's going to still be there. And there ain't nobody make you marry a white guy or a black guy. Nobody make you marry nobody. And if you don't want a white guy or marry a black guy, it's you. It ain't him. So what do you care? I don't care if you're white as snow or black as a spade. It's not me. that's stupid. Really. It really is. If you stop and think about it, it's stupid.
Well, thank you. This has been very, very interesting. One more comment here.
I said, white man is scared to death of the black man. And why he's scared to death of the black man? Because a black man, most of the time, that he gets the same break that the white man does, the black man outdoes him. Dominates him. Every time he gets the same opportunity that the white is to the white man, who dominates him? Anyway, why he does that? Because it's a gift of God. God give us the ability to be all the super. You take the Africans, all the dances they do today,
You know who originated them dances? The Africans.
Hmm.
And if a black ain't, don't the blacks dominate, especially in sports? When I came along, I couldn't even walk across the golf course. First thing you want to know, what are you doing over here? Quiet, God, get out of here. Wasn't even allowed to walk across the golf course. Now we've got a black guy that's beating them all over. Tiger Woods, if he went in the other way, if he goes all the way, I'm going to build one of them cabins for him. You know, out there. God, we went out there for Clarence Thomas and Powell, I'll get another for Tiger Woods.